I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Un petit bruit buccal, subtilement dosé, le chip est en danger.
Prenez-nous le chip!
Bonjour everyone, I am Kavidona and you are now listening to a spin-off episode of Le Chip. Why is this episode in English? Well, this summer, François, Mélanie and I offer you three solo episodes, one for each of us. Quite frankly, I had zero clue or inspiration for my episode. I was about to give up when suddenly, out of nowhere, Mr. Gene Demby reached out to me for a walking tour. I'm a tour guide. I immediately invited him on a show, and here we are, I have my solo episode. Gene is a journalist originally from Philadelphia. He used to live in New York City and now is based in DC. He is the co-host of NPR's Code Switch, a podcast about how race and culture often, always, overlap in America. From our Black French perspective, having a weekly podcast dedicated to race on the NPR, the American equivalent of our Radio France, is unthinkable. We are big fans of American shows, from The Nod to Still Processing, from Keep It to the Stoop, from The Read to Call Your Girlfriend. To our ears, they all sound so proud, fun, and unapologetic. But Gene's work was and still is a big inspiration for Le Chip. He has many things to say about politics, identity, and culture in general, especially when we recorded the episode. It was a couple of weeks ago, in July 2019, a few days after President Trump tweeted racist comments about four congresswomen of color. We had a great conversation about the census in America, the fear for identity politics in France, the return of race science, black athletes, and last but not least, reparations. Without any further ado, here is our conversation. Gene, welcome to Le Chip. Before we get started, can you please introduce Code Switch to our listeners?
Sure. So Code Switch is a podcast about race in America, race and identity in America. We have been around for about 5 or 6 years, but the podcast itself has been around for this actually 3 years as of May. In America, there is just like talking about race in America is like drinking from a hydrant. It's just so much to talk about all the time. So we are the team sort of dedicated to discussing these issues, which are complicated and they're always in flux.
There's a whole team behind you. Mm-hmm. So how many people in total working on the show?
So Shireen and I are the hosts. Yeah. And then there are 8 people who are either reporters or producers or editors around us. So, yeah, it's like 8 to 10. Yeah. Yeah.
Congrats.
And it's not nearly enough, considering all the stuff that happens in America. Every time something happens, every time, you know, the president of the United States says something wild or janky on Twitter.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
People are like, we need you to say something. And so, the team could be easily 2 times as large and we still wouldn't have enough people to cover all the stuff that's happening.
There is currently a lot of drama about the census in America, especially around citizenship. Can you tell us more about that? The way race is acknowledged in the census is really different from what we have here in France. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Sure. I mean, it was listening to you talk about how you have this entirely different approach here, like, was fascinating. A few years ago, I actually went to the Census Bureau, and we met with some of the researchers. And their whole thing is, like, we want all of the information, right? As much information as possible. There's even a line on the race question, which allows people to self-identify, because the categories we have don't fit for everybody, right?
Yes. So, like, like 5 or 6 big groups.
Right. And then you can sort of category. And so just to back up a little bit, the U.S. Census has been around since the first time the United States ever did it was 1790. And from the very beginning, race was central to the way the questions were asked, right? There was a question about how many free white men live in the house and how many free white women live in the house, how many children live in the house, and then how many enslaved Black people were in the House, right? And we do the census every 10 years in the United States. And at no period at no 10-year interval was that question the same. So in 1790, it looked different than 1800. Like, the questions were changed.
So if you live 8 years, you might change of category several times throughout your entire life.
Just the questions, of the answers available to you on the question would have been different, right? So, like, in the late 1800s, you could identify as an octoroon or a quadroon or a mulatto, right? If you looked at the history of the question and the answers available, you could also see sort of what was happening in the political moment of America around race, right? There was a lot of Chinese immigration in the late 1800s, so you started to see Chinese like show up on the census, and then you would see Japanese show up, and then you would see Mexicans show up, and then Mexicans were considered white people, so Mexican went away, and then it came back. Like, there's all these things happening in the way that Americans understand race, and you can sort of see it very clearly on the census form. And just like to sort of go down the rabbit hole a little bit, Homer Plessy, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Plessy versus Ferguson. It is this incredibly important Supreme Court case in the United States. It's the case that basically enshrines the idea that Black people and white people can be legally segregated. This is after slavery, and it enshrines this notion called separate but equal.
Like, so it's going to be the beginning of Jim Crow in the
exactly.
post-Reconstruction era.
Exactly. Before then, you know, there's this whole, you have these millions of Black people who are free, right? And suddenly you have to figure out what to do with them. So Homer Plessy is this man who's traveling on a train, and he is partially Black. I think he's either a quadroon or an octoroon, but he has a Black ancestor. He's light enough to pass for white, though. He's on the train, and then someone realizes that he is not a full white person, and so they say, you can't be here. And so he sues. He sues and says that I should be allowed to sit wherever I want. And so this goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, like, no, absolutely not. He's a Black person, so as long as the accommodations are equal, then the people can be separate. And this sort of enshrines segregation, racial segregation in the United States.
So there's an idea of racial hygiene,
mm-hmm.
that there's something wrong with Black and white people interacting too much.
But the reason I bring up Homer Plessy is that in 1890, Homer Plessy was identifying as an octoroon.
Yes.
By 1920, because the census is done in person, okay. By 1920, he's identifying as a white person.
Hey.
Yeah, and so, like, there's this thing, like, even this person who was central to the physics of racial caste in the United States was a person whose identity was, like, in flux, right, to him, right?
Oh, this is fascinating. So you're aware of the fact that racial categories are not perfect. So do you agree with the French method? No racial or ethnic categories at all on the census because they're imperfect. I am being the French white devil's advocate.
Are you calling white French people?
No,
white devils?
I'm not. No, I could get in trouble.
I mean, it's hard, right? I mean, there's all these sort of complications about the census question, right? Like, one of the reasons that the conservative and Republicans who want, and we know this because this is what their documents say. One of the reasons they want to put a citizenship question,
yes,
on the census.
Are you an American citizen?
Are you an American citizen? Is because they know it will depress the numbers of respondents in places in which there are large numbers of undocumented people, right? And those people are going to more than likely be Latinx, which is the term we use for people from Spanish-speaking countries, post-colonial Spanish-speaking countries in our hemisphere. Because there will also be sort of Asian American people, and it will be some African immigrants and Caribbean immigrants as well. But mostly it's an attempt to sort of depress the sort of electoral representation of people from those communities. And the census has been used in the past to identify people during Japanese internment in the 40s, right? Mm. They used the census to identify where Japanese Americans were.
Or after 9/11.
That's right, exactly, yeah. Right? To, like, identify where these communities are. And so there is this real concern, if you're from a historically marginalized community, that the census is used, this sort of information is used in this way, in these oppressive ways. But also, it is impossible to, like, extricate race from so much of the American story. that anti-racism, like most anti-racism efforts, will talk about explicitly, like learning about, to understand the physics of race in America, you need to understand what is happening racially in America, right? Like where people live, what is happening to them economically. And the census is a really important and useful way to do that. I mean, we know so much about segregation in America, ongoing racial segregation in America, because of information we get from the census. And so it is this tool that is neither a salve for these problems, right? Ignoring race on the census would, I think, obscure. I think I'm thinking a lot about what you were saying on the tour about the way that the French have actively tried to not think about race in this way. But it's important to remember that in America, it was literally written into our Constitution, like this sort of racial caste. And so understanding the ways in which that caste is perpetuated requires being able to wrap your arms around all the data out there. Who lives where? What kind of money are they making? Why are they, what are their sort of life outcomes? All those things are incredibly illuminating. And we can't sort of put the genie back in the bottle in that way. We can't sort of just say, these things don't matter now, because they've always mattered in America. They've always determined where you get to live, how long you get to live, what kind of health care you get, what kind of interactions you have with official institutions like the police. And, so all these things, all this data is incredibly useful to people who are doing anti-racist work, but it's also useful to people who want to use it for sort of nefarious racist ends.
You have mentioned healthcare. In a recent episode of Code Switch, you investigate about the return of race science. We do not have medicine for black people or white people here. What is it all about?
I mean, it depends on... I mean, we got a lot of feedback from, black doctors, right? I mean, I was reading an email that we got just the other day from a doctor who was saying, there's all these things that we should take into account specifically around black people. Because, again, if the argument is that we are all biologically the same, then we should not be taking race into account when we sort of determine... how do we administer drugs and how we prescribe drugs to people? And but that's controversial even among black doctors, right? And this is a whole complicated thing, in part because race medicine in America has been really racialized. Black people were test subjects for all sorts of horrible experiments, medical experiments historically. And so there's this long history of this sort of singling out black people and also Latinx people. I mean, during World War II, one of my former colleagues, Caitlin Dickerson, wrote this piece about how she discovered this program in which the United States government was testing mustard gas on black and Latino and Asian people because they believed because they're from warmer climates, then they would have these natural...
It's going to be cool.
Right, exactly, right. They won't, all sorts of, malaria and all these sort of diseases will not affect them. And so we can, test out these diseases on them. And so there's this long history of sort of racialized medicine in America. And so there's this, on one hand, the sort of mapping of the human genome opened up this whole world in which people are like, look, race is not a real thing. We should start treating people the same, which is important. And also there is this other reality, which is black people have way different medical outcomes than white people. And that is environmental, right? I mean, it's if you live in a place that has old housing stock, which has lead paint in the walls, I mean, you're going to have higher instances of all sorts of things.
What kind of food you have access to.
And that's a function of all sorts of stuff, environmental stuff. But the disparities are huge, right? These are racial disparities that you can see in the numbers, and they're not biological, but they have sort of biological... expression, yeah. Right? So we have these environmental sort of realities, the environmental racism of the world, right? Sort of playing out in biological ways. And so there's all this controversy over do we assume that, and that stuff is only helpful in the aggregate, right? If I know that black people in the aggregate are more likely to have high blood pressure, hypertension, what does that mean of how I diagnose you?
I live in a different context. I might suffer from something different.
Absolutely.
And it's not just because my skin in the same color as people who suffer from hypertension
exactly.
In one society, that it means that the people with the same skin
exactly.
color everywhere are going to have the same kind of issues.
So if I'm a doctor, do I come to you and say, we should also screen you yeah. for this thing? Knowing not a lot about you, but biographically, we know that you are a black person, right? And we don't know your other biography, that you are part of this larger diaspora, but we know this one thing about you. Should we then screen you differently? I mean, it's a really complicated and messy set of questions.
I have a really good friend of mine who happens to be white.
Okay.
And he works in the management of a hospital. And we were at dinner with lots of friends. And I was with my girlfriend. And as a fact, he said, you guys are much more likely to have diabetes. And he said, it's not because of race. It's because you both grew up in the Caribbean and blah, blah, blah. There are all these risks. Of course, we got offended. We said, that's so racist. but yeah, that's the I see the dynamic, what you're talking about. Something that for me really shows a big gap between our two cultures. Mm-hmm. It was exactly a year ago, July 2018, during the World Cup. Mm-hmm. At the end of the World Cup, France won the World Cup with a very black team.
Kylian Mbappe, yeah.
Trevor Noah from The Daily Show called it an African victory.
Yep.
And a lot of people in France got offended.
A lot of people in the U.S. were like, yes, this is my team. I'm riding for France. Yeah. Because look at all the black people on the team.
Yeah. Yes, I'm so excited. Africa won the World Cup. Africa won the World Cup. Africa won the World Cup. Africa won the World Cup.
You know what? For me, that conversation was like a car accident in slow motion. because the way we talk about identity, especially about the national team, when the national team was doing bad, like 10 years ago, people used to call them Islamic thugs.
In 1998, the French national team, called Les Bleus, won the World Cup, a moment that was celebrated throughout the country. And it seemed to be a breakthrough for French multiculturalism as well, since several players were either immigrants themselves or children of immigrants who came to France in the 20th century. But not everyone supported diversity, particularly nationalized politicians like Jean-Marie Le Pen.
I think it is a bit artificial to make these players come from abroad and to baptize them as the French team. I noticed that players on the other teams chant their national anthem with a big heart and a full voice, while I noticed that the majority of the players on the French team don't sing it or visibly don't know it.
Oh, wow.
So saying they were not French, not fully French, was an attack.
Wow.
So when people then, well, not French, say, oh, they're very black, so then they are the African team. A lot of French people with good intention will tell you, no, they're not. How can you say that they are French? But then it raises the question, when the team is good and they win, they are French, and how dare you Americans talk about their ethnicity without remembering that a few years ago, we were not that kind to the team. So there's this question of, I remember the French ambassador in the U.S. sent an open letter to Trevor Noah saying, it's a shame we don't talk about race this way in France.
They learn to play soccer in France. They are French citizens. They are proud of their country, France. The rich and various backgrounds of these players is a reflection of France's diversity. France is indeed, now that line there was interesting, the rich and various backgrounds of these players is a reflection of France's diversity. Now, I'm not trying to be an asshole, but I think it's more a reflection of France's colonialism. Because it's not like, it's just like random play, like they all have something in common. Like all of those players, if you trace their lineage, you're like, how did you guys become French? Like, how did your family start speaking French? Oh, okay, all right.
How do you think it's BS? Do you see where this is coming?
I remember when that open letter, I actually forgot until you mentioned it. And it seemed like a lot of people were clowning that ambassador. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, it was like this. It is so fascinating to try to look at race through the prism that you say that so many French people do, because it's like so central to American life, right? And the idea that you would not have like pride around those things, right? Like, I mean, like, there's a reason that people ride for Serena Williams. It's not just because she's the greatest tennis player ever, right? I mean, that's obviously a big part of it, but it's part of it is like she represents this community that is historically marginalized, and this universe of women in particular, black women that have been marginalized, right? And so there's like, of course you would, like, that is part of the celebration of her, right? I mean, it's essential to the celebration of her, right? And it's like, and no one would try to like disaggregate. Well, when people try to disaggregate those things, people get mad. It's like, you can't. That's part of it, right? It's like, you can't talk about Beyonce, right? And not talk about the fact that she's like, you know, the biggest pop star in the world, and also this black woman who is talking about is actually talking about her black womanhood, right? I mean, it seems like the same thing is true in sports all the time. Like LeBron James
represents Cleveland, and
right,
and a successful black man who
exactly
cares about the community.
From a very poor family, right? And he talks about, he's, you know, when he won a championship in Miami, he's like, I'm LeBron James from Akron, Ohio, a black kid from Akron, Ohio, I'm not supposed to be here, you know? Like, I mean, like, that's central to the way, and it sometimes it's sort of subtextual, but it's always there. It's always in the way we understand these things. And it's just really fascinating because American sports has been the place in a lot of ways where we legislate a lot of our racial issues, you know what I mean? It's like where, you know, for a long time, the most prominent black people in America were athletes up until, you know, like 30, 40 years ago. I mean, O.J. Simpson, unfortunately. O.J. Simpson. But it was people like that who were the most prominent black people in America because they were on TV and they were representing the nation. And they were often sort of forcing the nation to grapple with these things. But that's always been part of the way we've discussed these things.
We had a couple of months ago a whole episode about black athletes in America based on the Netflix movie High Flying Bird.
Yeah.
All about the Spike,
right?
Yeah, all the tensions, the racial tensions in the league.
You want to get back on the court. And as your agent, I want to get you there. But we are in a lockout.
And in France, in a way, sports is really racialized because football is a sport of immigrants. And immigrants became more and more diverse out of Europe. So that's an element in French society where you see different, like you can tell, you can read the different waves of migrations through the national team. I want to talk about reparations, but before that,
the light stuff, the easy stuff.
Yeah, right? I have a question about the perception or the vision of that African Americans have of black people in Europe. Like, do we exist? I'm asking the question because I saw the beef between Spike Lee and black British actors. Idris Elba, John Boyega, Daniel Kaluuya in Get Out.
Here, turns out you're not.
No, I'm not, yeah. By the way. I'm not American.
How do you feel about this civil war?
Civil war, oh man, the diaspora wars. It's so complicated, right? I mean, like, that conversation about black British actors, I remember it being really big around 12 Years a Slave, right? Steve McQueen is British, right? And then the cast was full of black folks, but not African-American folks, right? Lupita Nyong'o, Chiwetel Ejiofor, a bunch of people like that were in the movie. And so there was this whole conversation around, like, you know, like, well, wait a second. Like, there are these people who are not descendants of enslaved Africans in America, like, telling the story. Like, some of that was just sort of quizzical, like, what's that about, right? Are white people more amenable to hearing these stories about, you know, about this stuff if it doesn't come from African-Americans who were saying this stuff all the time, we were talking about this stuff all the time. And I think for some people it didn't matter, but for there was definitely like some sort of like, you know, yeah. And I think that there is, but I do think that there is a thing that I'm becoming more cognizant of all the time is, and you talked about this a little bit before, but like if African American pop culture and culture is so predominant, like it can predominate, not just like among black folks, but like just, it is in a lot of ways like the mainstream of American pop culture, right? And it gets sent onto the world. There's a way in which, like, the music and movies and cinema of black people around the world is invisible to us in America, like, to black people in America, right? Like, I think we're getting more of, like, that stuff. And so I do think there's a way in which, like, we are far less literate about, we as African Americans are far less literate about, like, diaspora. I mean, we are African Americans who are not like Caribbean or like recent West African immigrants or anything like that, are far less literate about the music and culture and sort of pop culture of other black people in the world, which I think is like a really interesting dynamic and illuminating about sort of American hegemony in general, right? There's a way in which we as black folks have been like the pariah class in America for so long, and also paradoxically like
center of attention for culture.
Absolutely.
If you watch an American movie, a biopic about some musician in the 1920s, you know the drill. He was an excellent musician.
Absolutely.
But he was black, couldn't make like, it.
Exactly.
And then white people stole his stuff.
Exactly.
And so yeah, that's a sort of American narrative, you would call it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it's a thing that we I think there's some myopias there on our part. I mean, I'm saying this like just editorializing. Like I don't want to speak for, you know, the 40 million other black folks in America, but it definitely feels like there is some there's a way in which that interchange is not going both ways, right? And I do think that like even you mentioned reparations, but even the conversation about reparations is becoming, in some ways, is a conversation about like who is black in America, yeah. right? Or black in this way, right? I mean, it came up around Barack Obama's biography. Is coming up. There are two black Democratic candidates running for president right now.
Yeah, Kamala Harris. Someone said she's not really African American. Right. She's Jamaican and Indian, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So she doesn't have this history of like her people don't come back, don't go back in the country to enslaved Africans. And it's not that people are saying that she's not black. People are saying that like there's a specific set of experiences that inform like. Her relationship to community that she doesn't have access to. And it's complicated because she went to Howard University, which is like the most famous black college in America. But like there's this sort of question about bona fides and that you know, obviously there's like no people are going to disagree over where the line is. But that those things become more salient when they have that you have conversations about this woman who was like who made her career sort of locking people up. You know what I mean? Like, so I mean, yeah.
So reparations.
Reparations. The light stuff. The easy stuff.
Last but not least, there was a conversation a few weeks ago in the House. It's a conversation about having a conversation about potential reparations. So for me, reparations is something that started to catch my attention seriously a few years ago with the piece by Ta-Nehisi Coates, The Case for Reparations, where it's not only talking about slavery, but about 100 years ago of oppression after the end of slavery.
Right.
Why now? Why is it in 2019 that finally the House says, you know what, let's talk about it. Is it Trump? Is it the 2020 election? What is it?
I mean, I do think part of it is... I'm going to ask you a question about the way that conversation is. Is there a reparations conversation here?
No. In 2001, there was I've mentioned that on the tour, there was a law voted by the Senate acknowledging slavery as a crime against humanity.
Right.
And in the original draft, you know, it's a legend. Uh-huh. In the original draft, there might have been a chapter opening a conversation about potential reparation.
Wow.
But I don't know where the chapter is going here. I don't think so. It's not in the agenda. That's not a priority.
How could you even have that conversation if you can't talk about race, right? If it's a thing that's frowned upon, how would you even get to the point where saying this group of people is a class of people, not class of people like.
But you see, this is the very interesting dynamic. There's no discussion about race in France, in mainland France, but in the region of overseas, in the colonies, there's always been discussions about race. There were laws for black people. There were the word black existed, of course.
Right.
So that's why also the conversation is so difficult. It's like most white French people will tell you we never ever had discussions about race in France.
Right.
When at the same time the French government was voting law racializing people in the colonies. So that's why also the discussion is so complicated.
Right. I mean, there's a version of that happening in the States. Right. Is that like white folks really do not know the history of race in America? Like there's just a sense that, like, you know, there was this place that Americans landed, or like the people who started and founded America landed. There's like very little discussion of like the ethnic cleansing of indigenous people that required that. Right? There's like very little discussion of like, you know, literally like American capitalism is built on enslavement of African people, right? So you have this like genocide of native folks, and you have this enslavement, you know, that went on for a couple of centuries, right? And there's not a real grappling with that. And so one of the things is that whenever we have these conversations about something as like policing, right? Like when there were a couple years ago when Black Lives Matter sort of started fomenting, there was this whole people like, I didn't realize this was happening. And people were like, we've been saying this literally for 100 years, you know? And so there's an element of that. And so part of the reparations conversation, and I think Ta-Nehisi deserves a lot of credit, although there have been people who've been making the argument for reparations for a long time. There are economists out there like Sandy Darity and thinkers out there like Alondra Nelson who've been talking about this stuff for a long time. But Ta-Nehisi sort of like laymanized it, and you know, he's a very obviously compelling writer about all the ways in which, you know, these people who are still alive had their wealth plundered, right, by government policy. So we don't have to go back to slavery. We can go back to, I mean, like, we can go back 70 years. We can go back to black folks who are still alive today who, like, missed out on this era.
Opportunities.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, and I'm not sure how much your listeners know this, but, like, during World War II, the United States government spent, in the run-up to World War II and during World War II, the United States government spent a ton of money, like billions and billions and billions of dollars, basically subsidizing the creation of a white middle class that did not exist.
Affirmative action for white people.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and affirmative action might be too tame because it was, I mean, it they gave grants to...
Socialism.
Socialism, right. But socialism just for white people, right? They gave grants to people who fought in the war, right? But black folks couldn't get those grants because they lived in racist places where they couldn't actually, like, get that money. And there were grants. So people used those grants to pay for college educations or buy homes. Well, colleges were segregated, so you couldn't use, you know, so there's all this, like, there's just this huge disparity in white wealth and black wealth because of that. And Ta-Nehisi sort of, like, very sharply pointed to this history, this recent, like, living memory history of this, like, racial caste and the way that plays out in the lives of, like, has consequences for all of us today. And so I think Ta-Nehisi deserved a lot of credit for that. And so that conversation on the House floor was so bizarre and so indicative of the way we talk. Because... he had one side where it was all these people who had, like, reams of data, right? And had all this history on their side. And the other side was basically like, I'm trying to figure out how to say this without getting in trouble, but the kind of black people who are beloved by white people.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. Okay. And it's not to say that you can't have a range of opinions on this stuff, but the kind of black people who are beloved by white, but specifically beloved by white people who are like, guys, you're making a big deal out of this. And then started talking about, like, black people sagging pants. You know what I mean? Like, you don't respect yourselves and your daddy ain't here.
Respectability.
Like, exactly. Like, yeah. So it was just like, it felt like a bunch of people on the side of reparations in that conversation were very serious. And a bunch of people on the other side were like the kind of people who are making the terrible arguments, but they're the kind of arguments that white people like to hear. And so, like... there is probably a bunch of very legitimate anti-reparations arguments there. I'm trying to, like, leave the possibility for that to be out there. And the people on that who are making that argument in the House against reparations were not people equipped to make that argument. They just weren't making it. And so it just felt like this moment in which, like, there was, like, this very serious conversation. This conversation had been very fringe for a long time. Yeah. Was
more
moving
mainstream.
More mainstream. And one side of the conversation was, like, marshaling all of the... the conversation had been happening in these very smart, like, black academic spaces for a long time, had been able to marshal all this research and all this history. And the other side of it was just like, reparations is an insult to me, and then you're going to make me feel bad. And it's like... And they're being held, like, sort of posited as equally weighty positions. And that's indicative of how race works in America all the time. You can have, like, all this historical analysis and all this data saying these are the ways in which people of color are treated differently and worse and the deadly consequences of that. And other people are like, you're making me feel bad. And these are the things
facts and feelings. It's complicated.
It was so indicative. And I do think the conversation about reparations is fascinating because it gets to, again, questions about who gets to be a black person, right? I mean, like, who gets to be among the legal class of people who will get reparations, right?
My whole entire life, my mom kept telling me, you're white. I never believed her because I knew I was black, but July 19th, I did some history. I went on ancestry.com, and I found I'm 25% black, and this whole time I knew it. I knew I was a black girl.
What would that look like, right? I mean, there's conversations about, like, well, maybe we give black people free educations, and a whole bunch of people are like, well, listen, education for black people doesn't work for the same way it does for white people. Like, black people with college degrees don't make what white people make is not a way to build wealth, you know? Like, and people are like, well, we can't talk about, we're supposed to just cut black people checks and give them to them. And some people are like, yes, like, maybe that's the way it works. Should it be some sort of, like, bond issue? I mean, and what you'll hear also is interesting from some of the scholars who've been thinking about this stuff for a long time is that they're broadly in favor of, like, anti-poverty, like, not just for black folks. They're saying that there needs to be specific reparative mechanisms for black folks, but also we should just have a mechanism that creates a floor so people can't be poor to begin with, like white people, black people, whoever, right? This is a larger sort of the problems of capitalism being addressed, right? But this is a specific injury to black folks. And so even the researcher I spoke to at a little bit, Sandy Darity at Duke University, who was talking about this, he's an economist, he's been thinking about this for a long time. He was saying that, like, you know, there's a bunch of conversations about what you do about Jamaican Americans and Caribbean Americans and how they make this claim. And his argument was, like, they have a claim to make. They just don't. Their claim is not with the American government, right?
It's to England, France, the Netherlands,
exactly.
Spain, or whatever. Yeah,
exactly. And so his argument is that there should be as many of these sort of lawsuits or many of these sort of arguments happening at the same time, but they're also discrete arguments. And so it's just a really messy and fascinating conversation. We're trying to do an episode on this in the near future. Just like, let's leave aside the political feasibility of it, right? Let's just talk about what it could look like. Like, if you were to do it, what would it look like? Just to, like, just game it out. Like, you know, just to, you know, like, leave aside whether or not it will actually happen. But I just want to circle back to something. I'm sorry, I'm, like, rambling. But something you said earlier was, like, whether it's because of Trump. I think it's actually because of Obama. Okay. There's this idea that this sociologist or maybe it's a political scientist called, like, the revolution of rising expectations, right? Like, there weren't riots in America until the civil rights movement happens, right? Like, there's this thing that happens in which black people start to ask for things and things start to change a little bit when they realize, like, oh, no, we can envision a world in which some of these things are happening. And also, damn, this is messed up. This is, can I curse? Am I allowed to curse?
Oh, yeah. We curse a lot on this show and in both languages. So,
okay, perfect.
Go ahead. Be yourself.
So, like, people are like, damn, this is fucked up. Like, you know what I mean? And so, like, you start to see the riots of the 60s are an expression of the frustration that, you know, you have the Civil Rights Act, you have the Voting Rights Act, you have these things that create new avenues for equality for black folks. And also, they're still so far away from, they're still living in substandard housing. Like, okay, like, these things are happening. And so people get, like, frustrated, like, every time these things pop off. There's a, like, we are second-class citizens, and this is, and so there's this frustration between, like, the sort of stated, the lofty rhetoric of the moment and the lived reality of that moment. And so there's people who are sort of argue that that is the riots of the 60s are a response to how far short was gold, right? And so there's also this argument that, like, Obama being the, like, literally the face of America to the world is this black man, right, with this, like, tall, beautiful wife from the south side of Chicago, the blackest neighborhood in the United States, the biggest black neighborhood in the United States. And then all the stuff is still happening. And people are like, oh, like, because before, the idea of a black president was always, like, a joke, right? It was always like,
I remember Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, yeah.
A sensitive accusation for this administration is the theory held by many that the real reason the U.S. is so interested in toppling Sodom is control of the oil that Iraq is sitting on.
What about people who say you're only interested in the Middle East for oil?
What? Huh? Oil? Who said something about oil, bitch? You cooking?
Everyone make jokes about this stuff.
Richard Pryor.
Yes. Right.
Mrs. Fenton Carlton Macker, Christian Women's News. Mr. President, since you've become president, you've been seen and photographed on the arms of white women.
What?
Quite frankly, sir, you've been courting an awful lot of white women. Will this continue?
As long as I can keep it up. I mean, why do you think they call it the White House?
And so Obama is this thing, and it's like, oh, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be like a party on the White House lawn all the time, and like all these things are going to happen, and this world's going to change. And suddenly it's like, I mean, I think people realistically knew that was going to happen, but I think the reality was like, oh, this dude is constrained, if not more constrained than any other president would be, right? And there's all these ways in which America is still messed up. And like,
what do you mean constrained?
Constrained by... constrained in the sense of, like, restricted, right? Okay. Like, the presidency has restrictions on it, but, like, he...
Yeah, especially with the Republicans.
Absolutely.
Work with him. Okay, that's... Okay.
And any Democrat might have some of the sort of Republican pushback, but, like, also, because of his blackness, to steal the way Ta-Nehisi phrased it, because of his blackness, anytime he touched issues of race, those issues became irradiated. Even if they were just, like, proximate to race. He talked about Trayvon Martin. Trayvon Martin could have been my son, right? People went crazy, like, oh my God, what is this man saying? Like, Trayvon Martin was a thug, whatever. What is it? And so there was this way in which he became more and more cautious. And people were looking around like, there are huge things, right, that we should be fixing in terms of racial justice in America. And this person, temperamentally and also politically, is not inclined to fix those things. And so there was an argument that you don't have sort of the unrest in Ferguson, right? Like, you don't have these civil unrest in Ferguson and all sorts of other places if you don't have Obama there sort of like as the face of America. And so people are looking forward like, oh, this is how far the dream is from the lived reality. And then you have the streets exploding.
So
right?
it makes it more frustrating.
Yes. It's like much more people are living in a space in which they can imagine a world in which things are better. And you're also living in a world in which, you know, like, you know, 2011 in New York City, there was this policy that New York City had on the books for a long time called stop and frisk, which was literally just the cops can run up to you, stop you, say, Kevy, you look suspicious. I'm going to go in your pockets, right? It was only Black and Latino people. There were, in 2011, there were 684,000 police stops. 90% of those were Black and Latino people.
Same issues in France.
Yeah, right, exactly.
There's been, because even if we don't measure race the same way, mm-hmm. there are still associations mm-hmm. or scientists making surveys on that, and mm-hmm. they realize that if you are seen as of African descent or mm-hmm. North African Arab descent, you're much more likely to be stopped and frisked.
Absolutely.
In Paris.
Yeah. I imagine just like in Paris, like none of that was ever, it's like codified as racialized, right? It's like no one's saying like, we're going to stop Black and Latino people. Mm-hmm. You just deploy the police in a way that you stop Black and Latino people. And so there's all these ways in which like Black people's movement through the world is like literally policed in this way. And like you would not have Black Lives Matter, right? If you don't have Barack Obama sitting there sort of like, oh, this is sort of central Black man is like central to American political power and is either incapable temperamentally because of who he is or politically of doing anything about it. Like, oh, we have to do this ourselves. Right. And so I think you see like the queer Black women who started Black Lives Matter and who pushed for this stuff. Like, really, I think it would have happened anyway, but I think Obama, in a sort of weird, perverse way, sort of catalyzed.
So is the conclusion, in a word...
Thanks, Obama.
I mean, like, you don't get Trump without Obama. Like, I mean, Trump becomes feasible, like...
First white president.
Right. I mean, white people, like, literally have never had to imagine an America, right? Like, in which they were not central to it, right? And suddenly, like, in this very subliminal way, well, not maybe not so subliminal, like, the face of America, the person who was on TV every day as the face of America was this Black person, right? Who made references they didn't get sometimes and, like, you know, and, like, people felt some type of way about it. Like, you can look at the poll numbers and, like, there's all these sort of, like, deep connections between antipathy for Obama and racial identity. Like, and so Obama, like... In one way, like, creates this sort of, like, revolutionary sentiment among Black folks, but he also, revolutionary sentiment among a certain universe of Black folks, right, who want to change things more radically, but he also creates this reactionary sentiment among white people, like, who are having to look at this every day and say, oh, no, 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 I don't want that.
So thank you so much
for
this amazing discussion. Is there anything else you would need to add or ask? I don't know.
I don't know.
No, we're good.
I mean, when we were on your tour yesterday, I was just sort of, it was fascinating because, like, you were talking about Richard Wright and this moment, like, of, like, la negritude, right? And you could see, like, Ta-Nehisi moved here for a little while, right?
Yes, you know? I had his family on my tour.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're wonderful. I think that, like, the idea of a colorblind society, like, after we've already sort of loosed the genie of race into the world is impossible. But I could see why people were so attracted to like, France, right? And people remain so, like, sort of enamored with it, right? Even if, like, the official sort of, like, sort of studied ignorance around race, right, that you were sort of mentioning, is, like, this, like... just like sort of untenable, sort of like this like polite fiction, right? I do think there are all these ways for a certain kind of Black person, like the people you were talking about, Richard Wright and Baldwin, all these people.
The intellectuals. Right,
To like live a life, right, that they would not have been able to live in the U.S. And I think there's something beautiful about that, but also like something deeply sad, right? You know, I mean, because, you know, the U.S. was their country, right? They should be able to be their full selves, their full beautiful flawed selves in the place of their birth. But also, like, there was a place that allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, there's something to be said for France for that.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's what I'm trying to do. So thank you so much,
man,
for being here. Everybody go and check Code Switch.
Yes, please do.
It's a wonderful show. You send my best to everybody.
Oh, thank you, man.
And you come back whenever you want.
Oh, man. If you're ever in the States, we're going to have you on Code Switch.
I can't wait.
All of the squad just come through.
I would love that. Well, that was my first episode in English ever. There might be some more content in English. There might be a Le Paris Noir podcast. Stay tuned. In the meantime, I want to thank Gene Demby for his precious time. That was a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much to all the listeners if you managed to stay with me with my Franglish. Please share the episode with your people. We'll be back together, Mélanie, François and I, in late September with more content en français. You can find me, Kevin Donat, on Instagram at Le Paris Noir. And for any requests, shoot me an email at leparisnoir@gmail.com. Bye!